everyone. We're having some technical difficulties this morning, so please mute your phones. We're not able to put this on listen only. Morning and welcome to this month's Hancock and Whitney Bank Economic Update Call. Hancock Bank and Whitney Bank provide this call as a monthly economic update for general informational purposes only. Information provided during the call is not intended to be investment advice. Opinions are those of the speakers and not necessarily those of Hancock Holding Company or its affiliates. This is Luther McDougall, Investment Director. I'll be the moderator today. If you have any questions, please email me at luther.mcdougall@whitneybank.com. Joining us this morning will be John Fortwood, Chief Investment Officer, Greg Hodlewski, Investment Director, and Jeff Tangus, Investment Director. John, let's get started with you. Last month was a volatile month in both the bond and stock markets as we got some different economic numbers that portrayed sometimes growth and other times weakness. Can you kind of discuss the overall economic outlook, touching on what's going on internationally also?
Thanks, Luther. When we had our interim report during all of the market volatility and excitement a week or so back, I may have mentioned some of this information then, but in case I'm repeating myself, just bear with me. We did have some new information on U.S. GDP for the third quarter. The first estimate was 3.5%. When you tear that 3.5% estimate apart, you find that a good bit of it was a strange increase in government spending, primarily defense spending, that seems to be a little bit in error according to some of our research sources that look at this sort of thing very carefully, and it probably added about 1% to GDP growth for the quarter that will probably disappear in the fourth quarter. So the 3.5 was maybe more correctly and should be more correctly interpreted to be, you know, something slightly below 3 because of that. Now, year over year, you're looking at, I think, a 2.38 or 2.39% year over year growth, which is pretty much in line with what we've seen year over year, quarter by quarter, as an average since 2009. So the trend appears to be pretty much the same as it has been. I think since 2009, again, it was about 2.3% GDP growth. Basically, I would guess that our trend, 2% plus or minus, is probably still in place. You know, for a number of years, we've talked about trend growth being probably lower for structural reasons for maybe a good number of years following, you know, the 2008 situation, and that's liable to be the case going forward, although it does look like we might be closer to 3% for a while than, say 2.5, given what some of the underlying trends look like. Unfortunately, we've got a situation in Europe that's not really getting any better at all. Europe is teetering on the edge of the third recession in the past 6 years, and their trend rate of growth is probably more like 1% rather than the 2% they've experienced historically, and that looks like that's going to continue for a while. There's nothing really new happening there that we haven't seen in quite some time. China is getting weaker. China has a real estate bubble that they're going to have to deal with, and you know, the optimistic outlook for China is that the real estate bubble will be handled, you know, reasonably well, and you won't have a total credit collapse in China, but that's a worry on everybody's mind, and the latest numbers out of China indicate GDP growth is year-over-year or something like 7%. It may actually be closer to 5, but in any case, China's not likely to add, you know, a lot of extra impetus to economic growth worldwide for a while. And again, the same with Europe. Brazil, some of the South American countries are not doing all that well either. So generally speaking, worldwide, you have a global economic condition that is not significantly different from what it was, you know, earlier this year or even at the end of last year as far as, you know, basic conditions are concerned. But it would appear that somehow, you know, a large number of economists and you know, analysts around the world were convinced themselves that growth was a little stronger or would be, I guess, a little stronger than the underlying conditions suggested. Consequently, when we got to the middle of this year and there was no pickup in Europe, and it still appeared to be stuck in the mud, and China would continue to slow, you know, my guess is that the market, just speaking generally, you know, looked at it and said, oh, things have not gotten quite as good as was thought, and maybe it's time to take a breather here. And that's probably one reason that we got that sharp sell-off in the market. Some catalyst or some piece of information was probably just one bit of data too much, and a relatively stretched and overvalued market was sent into correction. Now, you know, the drop was pretty precipitous. You know, again, based on something that I would not call a significant change in economic activity and outlook either here or abroad. But nevertheless, it reached an oversold point. We thought there would be a bounce. And one thing that helped that bounce along was Bullard, one of the Federal Reserve folks, who said, well, maybe we shouldn't taper QE as fast as we thought, and maybe we should come back in if things don't look too good. And again, this just makes the Fed look like they're interested in more supporting asset prices than anything else, but that gave a little bump to the market. Then we had the Japanese government come in, Japanese Central Bank, and say, oh, we're not doing as well as we thought with our QE program. We're going to ratchet it up a bit and go all in and make it the biggest monetary stimulus program in the world, including buying more stocks abroad and buying more stocks in Japan. And that added to the market impetus, I guess, when it was coming off the rally and made it even stronger. And that seems to have dissipated now that we're back near the old highs. But from a perception standpoint, it appears that the markets are still enthralled to what the central banks are doing, and everybody is still, I guess, expecting the central banks to essentially save the day and, you know, provide enough stimulus to keep things running. Or it may be just simply the fear that if they step away, things will collapse, which I doubt is really the case. But nevertheless, we've gotten into a situation here where the central banks are really acting as economic planners and turning dials and pulling switches in an attempt to, keep things, I guess, running at a speed that would satisfy everybody. But whether or not they'll be successful in generating significantly higher economic growth rather than just distorting prices at this point, I guess, is an open question. So
you want to go ice skating in Winter Park?
So the basic situation is one where economic growth is not really responding significantly to central banks' monetary stimulus. It's creating a lot of volatility in the market, and more than likely that's going to continue for a while. So that's kind of the story on the economic front. It's reasonably positive, I guess, from the standpoint we're having growth here and not recession. It doesn't look like anything significantly more negative is happening in Europe or China at this point. So my guess is that we're sort of business as usual and a lot more from an economic standpoint for a while and a lot more volatility in terms of how the market reacts to every twist and turn coming from the central bank.
Thank you, John. I'm sorry about all the interruptions, everyone. We ask you again to please mute your phones as we are not on listen-only mode. We are having technical difficulties this morning. And we do have another question for you, John, and that is today is a big day as far as the election is concerned. There's been a lot of talk about maybe the Republicans having a slight edge in this election, but it's coming down to the wire. Any particular thoughts about the outcome of the election and its effects on the market?
Well, one of the better, at least historically speaking, quantitative analysts in terms of predicting what's going to happen to elections is Nate Silver and his 538 blog. You can all check that out today and see what the latest number looks like. I checked it out yesterday. It was 69% probability that the Republicans would gain control of Congress, and I don't think in Nate Silver's opinion that is high enough to suggest that there will be a sweep, but it's probably high enough to suggest that the Republicans will end up you know, controlling the Senate when the day is over. Also, it looks like the Republicans are going to pick up, you know, quite a lot of seats in the individual state elections that are being held today. What the effect will be if that happens, probably not significant at this point, you know, given what's happened, you know, what the historic numbers look like following an electoral change. Some people have suggested that the Republican change in the Senate will, you know, bring about some significant changes in economic activity and economic policies, and that may eventually be true, but certainly in present circumstances it would take a few years for, you know, something like that to happen. So it would appear that also that the idea that the Republicans will regain the Senate is already in the market. So I doubt if it's going to be a significant market reaction to that either.
Okay, thank you. Greg, are you with us?
Yes, I am.
All right. A little bit on the stock market. Last month was volatile, as John kind of mentioned, with the economic numbers. Last month, well, actually beginning in September down to the bottom in October, the market fell, the S&P 500, about 7%. Before rebounding by the end of the month to reach new highs, can you talk a little bit about what happened and what did well, and also the opposite, what didn't do well?
Yeah, we did see a huge spike in volatility over the September-October time frame. In fact, the volatility jumped to its highest in 2 years. We had been averaging around a 12% in the beginning of September. And with a huge sell-off, the volatility index, which again is the implied volatility on the Chicago Board Option Exchange, sometimes called a fear gauge, it shot up to 26%, which was a 117% increase. We actually saw that decline from the September high, which was on September 18th in the S&P 500, down to about October 15th when we hit bottom. That was about a 7.4% decline in the index. And then, yes, we did have that rally up about 8.4%. And, you know, we were looking for a correction, but unfortunately it did really very little with that sharp upturn for valuation. So we're kind of right back where we started. But for the year-to-date returns, Dow's up almost 7%, NASDAQ's almost up 12%, and the S&P's almost up 11% through last week. So, you know, we're right on target again, appears, for having a double-digit year in the stock market. And, you know, some previous studies have suggested that single-digit years are rare. But, yeah, it certainly seems like volatility is back, so that's something I think that, you know, any equity investors are going to have to battle. In terms of what did well last month, just looking at the Russell 1000 index, and this isn't a big surprise, but when you do have volatility, people tend to go to defensive sectors. And so utilities by far did the best. They were up a positive 7.5%, healthcare up 5.5%, consumer staples up 3.7%, and the two worst performing sectors were energy, which was down 3.5% for the month, and materials, which were down almost 2% for the month. So those were the two sectors that actually were negative during the month of October. Now, what precipitated the decline? I think, you know, there were a number of things. I mean, we would have thought that with all the other things that were going on, geopolitical strife, economic weakness, that we would have had a sharper correction a long time ago, but we just had these little 2, 1, 2, 3% corrections, and the market shoots up. This time we had a 7.5% pullback. But again, it turned. But I think things that probably triggered the beginning of the sell-off, you had some strife in Hong Kong where you had pro-democracy demonstrations and protesters, you know, trying to get free elections. So that added to, again, geopolitical uncertainty. The Fed made some comments. Even though they said that they were going to keep rates steady or near zero, they did see some positive economic data, which could make them move that rate increase forward. So I think that spooked the market. Of course, we had Ebola, which, you know, that's a new variable in the whole market equation. We've not had to deal with that kind of a infectious disease on our soil, and that precipitated a 17% decline in airline stocks. And then the ongoing conflict in the Ukraine, even though they have a ceasefire, that continues to go on and drag on. And then, of course, overall euro area expansion is slowing. Fortunately, I mean, we're not taking off, but on a relative basis to Europe, the U.S. is still doing comparatively well. And as John pointed out, you know, the Eurozone and Bank of Japan is starting to do something there and to maybe step up their programs. But again, we're cutting back on QE. Japan's increasing it, so you kind of have to figure perhaps some of those dollars find its way into our market, and you know that could be a good reason why we not only were we just oversold in the month, but you know the market could be looking forward to a new infusion of funds.
Okay, thank you, Greg. And Jeff, the fixed income markets were not immune to the volatility last month, with the 10-year Treasury falling from around 2.5% to 2.1% before rebounding back up to 2.3, 2.4. You want to give us a little bit of an explanation as to what happened in the fixed income markets or what was different and how
sure.
It impacted the markets?
Will do, Luther. Thank you. It was really sort of a mirror image of what took place in the stock market. As is usually the case, turmoil in the stock market leads to a big rally in the bond market as people seek a safe haven, and this round was no different. As you say, we saw a dramatic drop in all interest rates, but primarily in government interest rates. Actually, you know, from a market close standpoint, we hit a 10-year government yield of about 2.13, as you stated. Actually, if you look at during the most tumultuous day there, October 15th, we had a 10-year hit down at 1.86% for a couple trades. So there was some real panic buying of securities as people were looking for a safe place to hide. It was really no different. The motivation for the bond market was really no different than what we saw in the stock market. By my measure, it was just a combination of things that people reached their tipping point on the fear factor. ISIS was not going well back in the middle of October. There were a lot of negative headlines there. Certainly Ebola, while not really an investment factor, had a tremendous impact on people's psyche. And there was all sorts of crazy extrapolations that, well, people would be so afraid of Ebola, they're not going to fly on airplanes, they're not going to want to go to public places, they're not going to want to shop. And as happens occasionally anyway in the markets, people just went way overboard in terms of extrapolating the effects of a possible Ebola outbreak. As we all know, that's ancient history now, so it looks kind of silly in the rearview mirror, but that was a little bit of what was going on. You also had certainly what was going on in Europe was a big factor, and that's probably a good segue into talking about how in this global economy what is happening around the world is having a tremendous impact on our interest rates. As we, as John mentioned, we're phasing out of our Fed stimulus program called the quantitative easing program. October officially stuck a fork in that program, at least for the time being. But around the world, people were just getting ramped up on QE. Different countries were starting to either implement or ramp up their own version of QE. As John mentioned, Japan announced the mother of all QE programs, and that had a tremendous market impact. That certainly was it is going to have an effect on interest rates around the world. But really, as important, or maybe even more important than that, is what was going on in Europe, or what is going on in Europe. And if you look over in Europe, where their economy is in the doldrums right now, their interest rates are far lower than ours. We think our rates are pretty low, but if you look at interest rates around the world and primarily over in Europe, you'll see things like Germany actually has
a negative yield on its two-year government security. It has a negative 5 basis point yield. France has essentially zero interest rates on two-year securities. Even some of the dogs of Europe, Italy, Spain, and Portugal, their interest rates are really about a third of ours. So in Europe, interest rates are dramatically lower. In a global economy, those sorts of things have a way of working their way around the world, and I think they're serving to keep our rates lower. One of the most interesting comments that I heard last week after Japan announced their big quantitative easing program was the Swiss Central Bank, who's been extremely concerned about all the loose policies with money around the world, came out and said that they're not going to stand by and have their currency skyrocket versus everybody else, and then in turn they would lose exports. That they are, and this is their quote, prepared to print Swiss francs by the boxcar if necessary to defend their ability to export. So that tells you a little bit about the global race, what's been dubbed the race to the bottom around the world in terms of currency and quantitative easing. Fortunately, our economy is in pretty good shape, and we're at the tail end of the quantitative easing, hopefully. So we're not directly participating or impacted by that aspect, but as a member of the global economy, we certainly are not immune from some of the side effects of that. So at this point, it continues to look like low inflation is low, likely to remain low with oil prices being down, and other commodities as well, actually. So it looks like interest rates should continue to trade in this range here, but remain relatively low from a historical standard. That's it for me, Luther.
Thanks, Jeff. We have a little bit of time left. I don't have any questions at this point, but I'm from the audience, but I'm going to give one to you, John. Back in June of this year, oil topped out at about $103 a barrel. At the end of October, we were $80 a barrel, and as of this morning, we're at $76.75 a barrel. Can you comment on the decline in the price of oil and what impact it might have on our economy and markets?
Yes. As everybody probably would imagine, it's a demand and a supply situation. Demand is falling because economic growth is relatively slow around the world, and you have a tremendous increase in supply. I cannot remember offhand just what the barrel per day number is coming out of the U.S. today compared to what it used to be, but it's pretty big. And also that adds to the supply. Also, the Saudis are not restricting supply in an attempt to raise the price and make more money. They appear to be going for market share, or some people said they're trying to punish Iran by continuing to sell oil at the current price and not do anything to try to hold prices higher. But for whatever reason, it looks like the main reason that oil is down is probably because of a lack of growth around the world. That probably, say that 60% of the problem, and 40% of the problem, I guess, is supply. And there's a lot of argument, of course, among economists about whether or not the decline in the price of oil is bullish or bearish for the economy around the world and the U.S. economy generally. But it does help consumers in the U.S., particularly from the standpoint of a lower price for gasoline, but there is a structural decline in the U.S. that's been going on now for at least 10 years or more in the demand for gasoline, and part of that is demographic, part of it might be cultural, part of it might be, the efficiency of automobile engines and so forth, but there is a very significant, apparently structural decline in the demand for gasoline and in the number of miles driven throughout the U.S. So, my guess is that, the decline in oil, while positive, will not necessarily, under current economic conditions, produce a significant demand effect. I think it's kind of a wash. So, also, when you go back thinking about commodities in addition to oil, the broad commodity index peaked in 2011 and has generally been declining ever since. Again, that's partially a supply problem and partially, you know, a demand problem, you know, as we've gone into a much more slowly growing economic world. And it's also deflationary rather than inflationary. So, you know, that's another reason why inflation remains relatively low, you know, compared to what might be expected given what the central banks are doing, because, you know, commodity prices are falling. But just a little side comment there on the price of oil. But for what it's worth, the research we're seeing in terms of oil prices suggests that the price we see today is probably where it should settle out and not decline significantly, you know, in the future. So we'll see how that works out. But we have at least at this point reached the downside estimate from a number of our research sources that are much closer to the, you know, to the oil business than we are. So we'll see what happens.
John, this is Jeff. I'd also add the point that I've read several articles, and we've talked about it, that iron ore, the basic building block of steel, mined out of Australia and sent to China, a couple of years ago, a metric ton of iron ore was $140 a metric ton. Lately, it was trading at around $80 a metric ton. And some of the big iron ore producers in Australia are implementing efficiencies and think they can drive the price down to $60. That's textbook deflation in my mind, and an indication of certainly a weak economy in China, maybe weak globally, and an indication of how not just oil but a lot of building block commodities are down substantially.
Thanks, Jeff. At this point, we have no questions from the audience. I'd like to thank everybody for participating or listening in on today's call. Our next call will be on December the 2nd at 9 a.m., and we thank you again for joining today's call.
Oh, this is the bottom of it?
Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. you've been drinking? Thank you. How's it going this morning?
Man, great. How about you?
Missed the meeting this morning. Got watch today, I think.
Y'all got watch list today?
Did you went and voted?
Damn it. I forget something. Yeah, I did go vote. I had a 10 o'clock call. Son of a bitch. Huh? Do what?
Brad.
Oh, Brad, okay.
I didn't know we could vote yet.
7 to 7. Y'all got watch. Is that right?
I think you got watch this morning. I heard you call him. Yeah, present pricing for that.
We're sorry, your conference is ending now. Please hang up.